This is CliffCentral.com.
Beth Comstock is an American businesswoman. I have perused her extraordinary resume, and let me tell you, this is a heavyweight if ever there was, and it's an absolute pleasure, Beth. I'm surprised you found some time to speak to me.
Oh, no, happy to talk to you, Gareth. Thanks a lot.
Thank you. Your book is called Imagine It Forward, Courage, Creativity, and the Power of Change, and it is a tour de force of kind of modern business principles. And what I love about it is it's a fresh take on so many things that other people have tried to put out there. And I really do think that if anyone who is going into business now thinks that they know all the things they need to know, this book is the outstanding pieces of the puzzle that will make you understand just how much is going on out there. So well done. It's terrific.
Great. Thank you. I'm glad you got that out of it. I appreciate it.
It's great. I just want to quickly, to give people an idea of where you come from and that this isn't just another business book. It's worth, if you don't mind, and I hope you're not one of those people who's shy about these things, but your resume is really extraordinary. You're the former vice chair of General Electric. You were named
by a small little company,
tiny little company that at one stage I think was the biggest company in the world. Forbes named you one of the world's 100 most powerful women in 2015 and in 2016. You're currently on the board of Nike. You had something to do with the founding of Hulu, which is again not small. Nike's not small. You were at NBC. This is some CV.
Yeah. Well, I've been around a while, so it was a lot more fun writing about it in hindsight than navigating a lot of those. Although I had a good time in my career so far.
Well, let's begin with the things that you learned at General Electric, which I think a lot of people would be interested in, and you do go into some detail in the book. But it seems to me that was an incredible environment to learn in, a difficult one, but an incredible environment to learn in.
Yeah, I think for one, GE has always prided itself, certainly in recent decades, as being a bit of a leadership development mecca, if you will, in a sense of, I think the company at the time I was there spent something like $1.5 billion a year in talent development. So what I liked about it was they invested in you, but they also expected you to invest in yourself. So if you're into personal development, which I am, and I think you hopefully get a sense of that in the book.
Yeah.
It ended up being a great place because there was a lot of investment to be made in your getting better.
Now you operated first of all there in business innovations, and that was to do with developing new businesses, markets, and service models. And of course, GE was not slow on the innovation curve, but it must have been an interesting place to do that because a lot of people talk about how important innovation is now, how much is changing, how quickly it's all changing. You got to see that firsthand, and you probably saw some really good and some really bad ideas in your time.
Absolutely. So I think, a way to think about it, especially with established companies, is you have things at scale, and they're making the profit, and the new things look silly sometimes, maybe cute, because they seem they're off in the horizon. I remember when we first started, when I was at NBC, which was owned by GE, and in the arrival of YouTube arrived in the scene, and the reaction was, oh my gosh, like isn't that cute? There's like cats playing the piano on video, ha 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 ha. And so that's usually the reaction in any kind of new thing that you're doing. And then as it starts to gain traction, fear comes out. But the kind of things I would have seen in the early days would have been that, the arrival of YouTube, things like 3D printing. I mean, 3D printing, we ended up printing in metal, but in the beginning it was a lot of printing in plastics and people making silly little things with plastic that seeming like it would never amount to anything. I remember driverless cars. GE didn't invest in cars. But we certainly invested in automation. And so for someone like me and the teams I worked with, you needed people who were always out there willing to go where things seemingly were silly or even weird, because that's where the future was starting to happen. And that's what I try to capture in the book.
How do you know, though? Because you could make a bad call. You know, business is very unforgiving. And if you make a bad call and people think you're silly, It can often be career limiting. It can prevent you from getting the promotion that you need, being taken seriously in the various roles that you had. How do you know?
Well, you don't know. And I think that's part of it. In those early days, you have to have a few people, a team that are willing to look silly to their peers. And so it takes a lot of, you have to build confidence. For myself, I struggled with confidence early in my career. I was somewhat shy and reserved, even introverted. And to me, it was that discovery of seeing those patterns. I remember early on bringing a group in that was investing in and creating platforms for Bitcoin and blockchain. And so you have to be willing to take some risks. And I remember the team I brought them in to meet with, they were like, I barely have time for this. And you also, so you have to be willing to put yourself out. You have to find the people with credibility. I call them sparks. You know, you're bringing these sparks in, inside, and they're provoking a point of view. And you have to be willing to translate it too. So there's a number of steps you have to do. It's not just, hey, look at this idea, now do it.
Right.
It takes a lot of time to, one, figure out, is that idea relevant to you? Where's it going to go? Get your colleagues comfortable that there's something they need to pay attention to, and then figure out what you're going to do about it. And all that takes time in a fast-moving world. In short-term focus of a lot of business, it's often seen as a luxury, not as an essential act.
I'm a bit of a history nerd, and when I think about General Electric, and I mean, you're even using the language and you call people sparks and all the rest of it. I mean, this was a company that was started by Thomas Edison and J.P.
Right.
Morgan. I mean, there's such a rich history there. There are thousands and thousands of patents that have that are owned by the company. We owe so much to the work of GE in those early days, and obviously ever since then, where they've ensured that they were at the forefront. And you've just mentioned a couple of things, from as diverse a field as 3D printing and Bitcoin, right through to automated cars. It's about the people, though, right? Because you can have that kind of legacy, but if you don't have fresh people with fresh ideas, you can miss out on the next big thing. And this is the corollary to what you mentioned earlier about finding those sparks and believing in them. The company also has to have the courage to back them.
Exactly. That's such a good point. And I mean, you mentioned Thomas Edison. I too am a history buff of innovation. And I mean, many of us grew up in school studying Thomas Edison as this archetype of an inventor. But he wasn't a lone ranger. He had a team that worked with him and other people that came to bear. And you need to invest in people who are different from you. I always found myself in this position where I was kind of the outsider inside, meaning my job was to find those things and translate them. And I had to know enough of the inside to be accepted. Mm-hmm. Yet I had to keep enough of the perspective to understand what it meant and to you know, understand that it was something new. And it meant often trying to sell ideas that people weren't ready for or didn't feel comfortable with. And you need a champion. You need someone in your organization. I had that in Jeff Immelt, who was the chairman and CEO, other people in my career who played that role, who were willing to say, let her go. She's on to something. Okay, I remember when we launched our clean tech initiative, there were a lot of people feeling very nervous about the fact we were potentially getting into solar or wind, which disrupted our core energy business. And I needed somebody to say, keep going. It's okay. I tell a story in the book of, as we were developing what became our EcoImagination platform, which was our clean tech platform, the sales team was really, many of the salespeople were worried about it because they're like, you're getting ahead of our customers. They're not ready for this. And yet we had talked to enough customers that said, hey, we are ready for new technology. We need this. But we lost a big customer as we were developing our clean tech platform to the tune of about $100 million, which was substantial. And Jeff Immelt never told me and the development team that that had happened. And I think because he believed he'd talked to enough customers, but he also knew if he rocked our confidence and he kind of made a big deal out of that, we might lose our nerve and the company would lose its nerve. So you need that kind of championship when you're going into something new, and you have to be willing sometimes to say no to something like a customer because you see more opportunity going forward. That's hard.
Well, I mean, it's borne out even in the story of Edison with direct current. He made a bet or two that were bad. So yeah. Nobody gets it right all the time.
Yeah, what I love about Edison too, that I think is relevant to the innovation discussion we're having, is again, people think of him as this archetypal inventor, but he was also a great storyteller, a visionary. I like to think of him as a marketer. He had to convince people. There's this amazing story of him in 1884 marching in downtown New York City with 400 men. With light bulbs on their head, tethered with these huge electrical cables, because he wanted to prove to people that electricity was safe, that these men wouldn't be killed. These people took an incredible risk, but it was a parade. Basically, he called it his torchlight parade. And so I think that's sometimes what you have to do when you're backing some of these early ideas that are scary or literally potentially life altering. You have to be willing to get out in front of it and show it in a different way.
Now, you were also in 2003, just to stick with GE for a minute more, you were the first marketing officer in more than 20 years, and you created their Eco-Imagination, which you just spoke about now, and an initiative, obviously, to drive environmental impact. It wasn't popular with everyone. You said you lost clients. But it must be a monstrous thing to market a company so huge and with such enormously diverse interests.
Well, it is. And I think that was one of our ongoing challenges, because we had this amazing brand, GE, General Electric, but increasingly it just meant GE. And we had such a diverse portfolio at the time when I first came into that role. We even had G Capital, which was financing. We had jet engines, locomotives, energy, healthcare. We even had a pet insurance business in our finance. I think finance had 27 business units. And you had to find a few key technologies to hang your brand on, and then you had to work really hard to find the commonality. And over time, we had to prune our portfolio because they just didn't go together, and it didn't make sense as a brand proposition. And so we really ended up focusing on technology, kind of technology that has an impact in the world in terms of literally making the world go round in terms of transportation and electricity and healthcare, that at least had a common story, but it took a while to get there.
You also then, you know, went on and did something that a lot of people aren't able to do. Instead of staying there for the rest of your life and you know, increasingly kind of demanding more and more money and becoming a bit of a barnacle in the system, because that tends to happen with people who've reached their imagination capacity, you did what very rarely happens. You decided enough in October 2017. I'm out of here. It's time.
Yeah, I knew I was at the end of my GE run. Jeff Immelt had been in his job. I was part of that leadership team. I'd started working on the book, but I honestly didn't expect to leave when I did. There was a lot of change afoot in GE, and short-term activist investor took a position, and a new CEO was named in June of 2017, and he wanted a new leadership team. So while I might have been thinking I was going to be able to have some control over my exit, I didn't. And I left much faster. And I call myself a change maker, not because I'm making change. I'm just trying to understand it, grab it. Frankly, I haven't figured a better word, but I must confess that just because I hang around change, it doesn't mean I like everything that happens either. And I didn't control that exit, and I had to get my head around it.
Well, was that difficult? Did it set you back? You spoke about confidence earlier.
At that point, because I had spent 25 plus years at GE, I would say it was less about confidence, but more about, okay, what's next? I talk a lot in navigating change, I'm trying to unleash people's tolerance for ambiguity. This idea of you know, the old's going away, the new's coming around, and neither's fully done yet. And this notion of ambiguity in business is—I feel pretty good about it. But suddenly, for myself, that was challenging. What do I do with myself now? So, in some ways, this past year has also been about me taking some of my own, what I've written in the book, and putting it to work again for myself, as beginning again as a beginner, and giving myself permission to try different things. Going out and discovering some of the things I may want to do that are new and next, experimenting, trying different things. So that's some of what I've had to do in this past year, basically the advice I'm putting forth in the book.
Well, I think you may be being unfair, because it's not as if you were only doing the one job. You've had a lot of concurrent interests, and it seems to me that you're the kind of person who likes to have many irons in the fire. I mean, I certainly know NBC was a part of what GE was doing, but that whole career is almost a separate book on its own.
Yeah.
You know, you got, while you were at NBC, of course, a hugely successful media business. You were president of Integrated Media there. You saw ad sales, marketing, and research fall under your portfolio. You led the digital efforts, including Peacock Equity. You acquired Village.com. You saw the founding of Hulu. I mean, these are enormous things, and that's just in one division.
No, absolutely. And I think as I try to make sense of certainly my career and people like me who kind of go these paths in companies where you're agitating for the future, you're trying to grab change and make it help create your way to the future, there is this sense of kind of continual renewal and continual reset. And not everybody in the company feels they want to do that or need to do that. I think what the point I'm trying to make in the book, or you know, any conversations I'm having these days about this, is that we need to make room for that kind of path. However, we need more people who are willing to reboot and reset and kind of continually try new things in our companies, because it's the only way what's next and what's new are gonna be grabbed onto. So I have been able to have that working on a big platform like GE, but I'm also that kind of personality type. And I think we need more of that in the world, where we allow in established organizations, especially in institutions, we allow people who operate at a different speed, who need to continually renew and be refreshed with new learning.
Well, you know, you had, while you were there, and this is also a temptation that a lot of people probably would think was too good to resist. You resisted it, and I can't really tell even from the book whether or not you regret this. But you were offered jobs twice, not just once, but twice, from Steve Jobs at Apple.
Yeah. And I share that story for a couple of reasons. I was at NBC, and in the book I share that last time I was at NBC, it was a particularly tough assignment because the digitization of media was happening. People were scared. I was leading the charge with a team, and it was a lot of tension and conflict, as I document. And so I had a lot of reason to want to leave. Through the course of my job, I got to work with Apple, and they came to offer me a job. And I had reason to get to meet Steve, and picked up the phone one day, and he's like, "We'd really like you to be here." And I said, that happened twice, and I said no both times. And I put it in the book for a couple of reasons. One, I did regret that at times, because it was the path not chosen. I remember my husband and I sitting as I was going through the second offer, and like, how good can their stock ever be? I mean, really, how big can this company be? I remember Jobs saying something like, you know, it was right as the iPhone was starting to pop, and he was like, things are going to get really big here. And I'm going, how big can they be? So I didn't really imagine it forward. But yeah, there's a bit of regret, because I didn't pick that path. I didn't pick a path of maybe being tested from a very tough boss who was this innovative force. At the same time, I knew myself, and I knew what I wanted. I wanted more content. I was loyal to my company. So I had good reasons for not picking that path, but sure, there is regret sometimes. And I put it in there because I think, especially in business, in your life, you pick a path and you have to make it work. And that's what I was trying to show, that I picked a path and I had to make it work. And yeah, there are going to be times you're going to be like, shoulda, coulda. The innovation history of people is just rife with people who shoulda backed this, coulda done that, and they didn't.
Well,
and you just got to keep moving.
Yeah, you know, if there's anything that I took from the book, it is that it is worth taking risks. And even when you decide to go a certain way and it doesn't work out for you, there's no point in holding on to regrets for too long and letting it sidetrack you or slow you down, right?
Right. I do think what I try to also share is just, I think you do have to wallow sometime in when you fail, which you have to. How can you succeed if you're not able to fail? But this notion of when things don't go right, when businesses don't happen, jobs that you thought you were going to get don't happen, you can regret it. It's a loss. An idea doesn't get funded. It doesn't go forward. You're mourning a sense of potential. And so I think it's really important and healthy to feel bad, suck your thumb, go, oh, I feel horrible. But then you have to pick yourself up and go, okay, what did I learn? And how do I kind of use that to go on a new dimension? So I do think, again, I don't think we do enough of that in business. One of the things we created with the team, one of the teams I worked with, is we came up with something we called a failure convention. We called it FailCon for short, which was our chance to together go back and say, you know, here's where I failed. Here's what I learned. Kind of group therapy, if you will, about failure. I think those things are important in teams.
People don't like to do that, though. I mean,
they don't, you know, because it's shameful. You think it's shameful. We all want some vision of success. We think you're wasting the company's money. You're wasting the company's time. And some of that may be true, but the point is to do that when the risks are smaller. So to your question about risk, I mean, you can't avoid risk. It's impossible, but you can get a better sense of necessary risk. You can try things at an earlier stage with less money and then get confidence. And so you put the right amount of money at the right stage. I don't think many organizations do that well.
Do you think big organizations are harder to do that with than little startups? And this is almost a lesson of where we are in the world now, that these little companies that come out of nowhere can really derail the enormous dinosaurs and the massive institutions that have had years and years of experience just because they're willing to go in a direction that perhaps the others are too frightened to do, or the others are frightened to commit money to.
Yeah, it's such a great point you're making. I think we need both. And the startups are particularly good at focus, at knowing the market really well. They've studied a place where either something's really bad and they can make it better, or it's not happening. And big companies, they become comfortable. Their machine is making money the way they always have been doing it. So they don't want to risk something. They also have investors often if it's a public company. And yet I think we need to think for a minute about some of the smaller companies, because they want to grow bigger. They want to get to scale. They have to start taking different kinds of risks. And at scale, maybe they get into a method where they can't take as many risks. I mean, if you're in an Amazon or a Google right now, they're becoming the big monolithic established companies of our day.
Well, they've got a lot to lose, right?
They do. And are they? You might argue they probably don't have the same risk tolerance that they did. And then also think of a company like an Uber, where they scaled so quickly, they were not able to grab at them. I think they're doing it now, but culture was a big challenge for them. And big companies have figured some of those things out: integrity, culture, how you treat your customers and employees well, whereas small companies often think they don't need that in the early days. And we're seeing what happens when that comes into play.
You know what I also loved about your book, and maybe this is territory I shouldn't wade into as a man, but I thought that it was really interesting to see that you didn't consider it an extra challenge that you were a woman. You almost considered it like a secret superpower. and I loved that, because there are a lot of, clearly, you know, for women in business, there are things that just make it a whole lot harder. And I suppose you can either see that as an opportunity to, you know, to outdo the competition and score a huge amount of cred with, or you could see it as a problem. And in all of your roles, what was it like, especially in the early days? You know, we look at the world now and it's a lot easier than it was 10, 15 years ago. Do you think that being a woman was a secret ingredient? Do you think that there were, or do you think it's individual? I mean, it was just you.
Well, I think it's a little bit of both. And I tried to document some of that. There were definite struggles, definite issues where I know being a woman articulated my difference. And especially I was a woman more in creative field, strategy and innovation, that in a tech company seemed kind of soft. So I had a couple of things, you know, that made me different in that respect. And sure, not feeling heard, especially as an introvert, not feeling heard and being quiet. There were a lot of things I had to work on to make myself be heard and to put myself out there. But I couldn't change that I was a woman. I didn't want to at that point. You couldn't, and I didn't want to at that point. I think I had to step into my confidence a lot. And I point out in the book, there were times when I struggled with that quite a bit. where, you know, where I had real challenges, where I had my boss at one point saying, like, what's up with you? Like, I put you in the CMO role and you're not showing up enough. I expect you to be more confident. So I had good champions and mentors who gave me feedback. I had to learn to be open to it. But I did at certain points kind of embrace that difference as I got more confident. And I think that's part of just life and experience. And I do think as a creative woman, I might have been able to be a bit more creative because I was a woman than perhaps some of my creative male counterparts. So that might have been a superpower that I, in hindsight, am aware of that I might not have been at the time.
Well, I mean, you've also got two daughters. You're married. You watch TV like the rest of us. You know, you're a normal person. And in between all of this, it is an extra kind of responsibility that a lot of people don't entirely understand or grapple with. You say in the book, and this I loved, don't always assume the answer will be no.
Yeah.
It's such a simple thing, right? But explain
no
why.
No is not yet. Exactly. To me, it's no is not yet. And again, this is something learned because we all have gatekeepers in our lives. And unfortunately, maybe we've even been one. And by that, I mean somebody who doesn't let you go through the gate. They say no. They say no because they like control. They don't like imaginative thinking. Or maybe it's just a bad idea. But often at the first no, you don't know what the situation is. And I can't tell you how many times I've seen people come in to pitch ideas, they're told no, and you never hear from them again. And you're like, well, that must not have been a good idea. And I share a story of it. I was at NBC at the time, and I was trying to pitch what we called our NBC Experience store. It was a great experience. And the first time my boss, Bob Wright, said no, and we just knew this was a great idea. And we did our homework, came back the second time. By the third time, he finally said yes. And I remember him looking at me and saying, you know, I wanted to say no. I tried to say no, but you made it so darn hard to say no because we had done our homework. We made the business plan better. We even did little dioramas to show him what everything would look like. He made us better. And the learning I got out of that is he was testing us. He was saying, how far are you willing to go? And so I think any of us who are in a position to greenlight an idea or a team, you need to give your team feedback to say, like, no, that's never going to happen, and here's why, or maybe it's not yet, and you need to keep working. And if you're that person and you work with somebody who's saying no, keep going. I once went for 6 years to pitch a digital health idea. Now, that might be stupid, but you got to keep, if you believe in something and there's a potentially viable path in your company, don't you owe it to the future to keep pushing?
Well, it takes an enormous amount of persistence and you know, kind of just dogged determination to make that happen too. A lot of people, some very sensible people would have given up after after 3 years of trying. It's a long time.
Yeah, and I think that you're making a really good point that in some of these moments you're not sensible because you've been out in the world. You see patterns, you start to see where trends are happening. You're not predicting the future by any means, but you kind of see a momentum of where things may be going, and it gives you a confidence and a belief that we're going to miss out. We have to be part of this. And I think that overcomes the doubt. And of course, you have to be respectful, and you know, you don't have to fight your way through. You won't be able to do that often. Part of what you're trying to do is help other people see that in their way. They have to make sense of it themselves. It can't just be because I came in and said it and I'm some cool kid who saw the future and you didn't. No one's going to listen to you. They have to feel they've seen it. They understand that change. When 3D printing was coming in, one of the things we did is we plopped little 3D printers around the engineering teams. And we came up with some games that might be kind of silly, but some of the most curious engineers in our aviation business said, you know, I'm going to play around with this. And they started taking it, and it was in plastic, and they took it to customers and started prototyping stuff. There was another group that were like, not sure about this. I want to see what's happening. And so they watched those other curious ones and gave them confidence. And then there was another group that was just like, we're never going to do this. And I think that's what we have to think about in change. Not everybody is going to go at the same speed. Not everybody's going to make it. And in your company, maybe there are different roles for people who are less, you know, open to change. But with the pace of change, I think there are going to be fewer and fewer of those jobs going forward.
What about the time you spent with Ted Turner? I mean, he's got an interesting, you know, now when we look back with the benefit of hindsight and we see some of these very visionary moves he made at that time, and we look at where CNN is now, and, you know, kind of the president of the United States is their enemy, effectively.
Yeah.
I mean, these are things that were completely unpredictable. But what was it like working for a guy like Ted Turner?
Well, he was, if I sort of take everybody back in the Wayback Machine, he was kind of the swashbuckling media titan of the day, kind of a Richard Branson of his day, if you will, invented CNN. And he was very outgoing. And my job at the time, I was 30 years old, and I was working as the publicity director for CNN and Turner Broadcasting. And I was very shy, and I did a good job, but I share in the book how I worked for him for a year and he didn't know my name. And I was sort of one of the examples of how I had to overcome that, what was holding me back. I remember we were at the UN and I'm like, okay, today's the day I'm going to give myself permission. I'm going to get out of my own way and I'm going to reintroduce myself to him and make sure he knows my name. So I wait for him outside the men's room, as one does when your boss goes into the men's room. And he comes out, I go, hi, Ted, sort of summoned whatever courage I could just to say hello and hi, I'm. And before I could even get my name out, he shakes my hand. For one, it was incredibly wet.
Oh, so boy.
It was awkward. Oh. And he kind of looks at me like, what do you want from me? And he walked away. He never learned my name.
Oh, boy. And,
but I use it as an example. One, he was just kind of, that kind of person. But for me, it was like a very proud moment because I had actually put myself out there. It was awkward as heck. It was so awkward, right? It was so embarrassing, but I put myself out there. And so it was always one of those instructive lessons for me that even if it's awkward, sometimes you have to put yourself out there, just one small step forward to make behavior change.
I got to say that I want to talk about Nike in a moment because you are on the board there, and I'd love to know just what it feels like to be on that board in a meeting, knowing that you're part of a team that is just right at the top of retail, of apparel, of design, of, you know, they're a risk taking company. They've done some very forward thinking things in the last little while. What is it like to be there? And, you know, without obviously telling us what you guys decide, just explain how it feels to be in that room.
Yeah, well, Nike is an amazing company, and Phil Knight's still on the board. And I think to be in a company where he's no longer chairman. Mark Parker's the CEO and chairman, and just one to be in a company where one of the founders is still there, I think creates, for me, it was just a great insight to see the passion. Mark Parker's an amazing CEO and the team is very innovative. That's what I've loved learning from them, their ability to be very focused, and they're incredibly focused on the athlete. And I love that little Nike saying that it basically said, they're there to help the athletes perform better. And there's a little asterisk over an athlete. And it says, like, asterisk, if you have a body, you're an athlete. So it just, their focus, and they're constantly raising the bar. They're focused on their athletes. I like what they've done recently, especially to reinvigorate the Just Do It tagline.
Yeah, with Colin Kaepernick, yeah.
Exactly. And Serena Williams and some of the other great athletes, they realized that they had let it get maybe a bit stodgy and it didn't really have the sharp focus they needed. So they sort of went to their athletes and said, let's tell your stories to show the power of sports to impact social good. So they're willing to realize that they sometimes can get stale and need to reinvent themselves. So I think there's a good lesson in that.
It must be, and I noticed you say they, but do you view your time on the board of a company like this as almost like a political appointment? You know, if you're a president, you're not the president for life. You're partaking in this journey for a little bit. What's your attitude to these companies that you've worked with?
Yeah, I love that you saw that. I it's interesting. I mean, it is a bit as a board member, we're there in a governance role. We're there to support, to make sure the company lives as long as it can. So you do have a bit of an outside in perspective. When I'm in a board meeting, trust me, it's we, but we're not running the company. The board doesn't run the company. There's an accountability there that the leadership team has to the board and to investors. But on a board, you have to remember You have a leadership team that's their job. So I think that's an important distinction I'm trying to make.
Well, it's interesting because I think a lot of boards overreach, and I suppose some of them also want to be informed about everything. And for example, with this with Serena Williams and Colin Kaepernick, are you guys told about that in advance, or do you get the report, you know, sort of quarterly or every 6 months, or you get an email from them?
Well, we have regular board meetings. They keep everybody up to date. They ask for feedback on strategy. So, you know, you understand where they're going, but certainly Mark Parker doesn't need to get the board's approval to run an advertising campaign. And they keep us apprised when things get heated up, as obviously the Colin Kaepernick thing did. So, you know, they keep us in the loop, but Mark runs the company, and I think we're pretty clear on that.
That's amazing. I'm also really moved by and interested and intrigued in your involvement in, among other things, the National Geographic Society. You're a trustee.
Yeah, I love this group. I mean, they've been around, oh, I think 100, I should know exactly, I think 150 years. And I love nature. And the society now is really a nonprofit group. They have the programming arm that's also owned by Fox and soon Disney. Mm-hmm. But their mission is to make sure we take care of nature, and that you know, they're doing some incredible work right now about plastics in the ocean and conservation. And that's just important. I think any business in the world today, I just was on a panel about sustainability, and I think we need people who continue to show us what's happening in the world. I thought the plastics work that National Geographic did was amazing. We needed to understand what we were doing to the world. And if we're not telling it through stories, how are we going to understand that? So they play an important role.
How difficult is it? Because we live in a world now where everybody has social media, where everybody's expected to comment on the issue of the day. And obviously, you know, I've learned sometimes that it's better to shut up and to stay out of everything. But people almost expect, when you're as important and as powerful a business person as you are, that you will have points of view on a number of things that you don't necessarily need to get involved in. How do you decide which ones to get involved in? If there's some political stuff going on, do you just shut up and say it's none of my business? Do you sometimes become a bit of an activist yourself? How far can you go? It's a really tough job, and something that wasn't in, you know, the role of a person on a board or a chief marketing officer or a CEO 20 years ago.
Yeah, it's so interesting. I mean, how many times do we, if you're on Twitter, do you see some individuals who say opinions are my own, not my organization? I think those lines are blurred a lot today. I think if you're working for a company, you also are for that company. That being said, everybody, I think, is expected to have an opinion on things. I think it's really hard for companies to wade into politics, yet they have to be very strong in standing for what they believe in. Mm. And I think it's back to strategy. I think it's back to values. Employees want to join companies that match their values, that they believe are on a mission for the better in the world.
And so do customers, especially millennials,
customers,
right?
Exactly. Yeah. And they expect their brands that they're doing business with to stand for something.
Right.
And so I think it's a lot about knowing what you value, being able to express it. That's a filter. So you're not reacting to everything. You're not just there to be a loudmouth, I hope. And you know, knowing when you're going to say something. And it, to me, these days for companies, it's about brand courage, in the sense that it's knowing what you stand for and knowing what your customers expect, and do it. Just do it. To do the pun. But I think that is the world we're in. And I think brands that aren't going to have the courage because they're afraid perhaps of the backlash,
yeah,
they're going to have a hard way going forward. If they can articulate their strategy, articulate why it's important, they should be able to defend that position, even if it's not popular with some segments.
Beth, I also found out that if you could have been anything else, and I'm sure you don't have regrets about your career, you've had a very interesting and colorful one with lots of variety, but you say you might have been an anthropologist. I'm sure you would have read Yuval Noah Harari.
I really like his work.
Yeah. I was just thinking, where do you think we're at? Do you think humanity is in a dangerous place now where we could end up being, you know, kind of held hostage by all of this incredible progress and technology? especially with the hindsight of being at General Electric, or do you think that this represents the greatest opportunity ever for human beings to evolve to another level?
Yeah, I'm torn about both. I mean, I do think we're on the cusp of amazing, not just evolution, but revolution in terms of our human capacity and capability. But it also means there's a tension, right? There are certain parts of the world that want to go backwards. They want to pull what worked yesterday and try to apply it to today. So we're going to have to work our way through it. It's one of the reasons I wrote the book was to talk about, like, let's not lose our humanness. I mean, it's about imagination. It's about creative problem solving for the future that can't be reduced to an algorithm. Algorithms and all the data in the world are not going to be able to, I hope, keep pace with the creativity and the unexpectedness of the human brain. And we have to invest in that. And I worry about us giving up on that a bit as we invest more and more in technology and data and certainty. So as an anthropologist, I'm about human behavior. And as an armchair anthropologist, I would say, I think it's about don't forget our humanity and how we behave. And that's what I think we need to remind ourselves of.
Now, you studied biology, and when you were a student studying at William and Mary all those years ago, did you ever imagine that this would be the kind of career that you might have had? Was there at any stage in this incredible story, which you tell in the book, was there any stage there where you thought, this is wrong for me, I should go back to biology?
Well, no, but I did. I thought I wanted to go to medical school. And really what I had this awakening that I wanted to be a storyteller about science. And that's how I ended up in media. And then ultimately media led to GE. And for me, I kind of feel like that's been a consistent thread for me for my career. I didn't set out to get into business, but storytelling became my way forward. And I love stories. I mean, that's some of the work I'm proudest of at GE, were the stories we told about the way things work, the science behind the scenes. Mm. We made it interesting. And to me, story is strategy. And strategy is a story. It's where are you going in the world? Where did you come from? Where are you going? Why is it relevant? Why do I care? And I think we need that in business. It's not just about numbers. It's about our connection and where we're going.
Well, I couldn't have said it better. Thank you so much for taking some time to speak to us. The book is incredible. I would recommend it to anybody. It is called Imagine It Forward, Courage, Creativity, and the Power of Change. And we've heard just a little bit of some of the things that get discussed in here. Beth, thank you so much.
Gareth, thank you so much. I've really enjoyed talking to you. Great, really thoughtful questions. Thanks
for
the opportunity.
Thank you. Thanks very much. Have a great day.
Okay, so long. Bye.
Bye-bye. This is CliffCentral.com.